Explicit content is found in this episode. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. I've heard people say that young minds are malleable. They can be molded by those who are able to captivate them and entrap them. Think of the killer children you've heard about in your podcast listening. You typically can point to a source and say, aha, that's why they've killed. It might not make rational sense, but you can see how they could be peer pressured into doing something terrible. In this case, you're going to be left wondering if these teens were coerced by the Pied Piper of Tucson. Okay, on to the show. Charles Howard Smith Jr. was born on July 8, 1942, to an unknown unwed mother in Tucson, Arizona. He was adopted on July 9, 1942, by Charles and Catherine Schmidt. His childhood was relatively unremarkable. He was known to be very curious growing up and was often called a trickster. He led a privileged life and wanted for nothing. His parents owned a nursing home in the Tucson area. This afforded them the opportunity to give Junior everything he asked for. He took to gymnastics at a very early age and made his parents proud with his agility and success with the sport. He was so successful in the sport that he took his high school team to the state championships when he was just a junior. As he matured, he was still known to be polite and well-mannered. He would spend fall breaks with his friend Paul Ginn, hunting for rabbits, squirrels, and birds. He was a disinterested student who didn't care much for his studies. As a lackluster student, his parents cautioned that he would be sent away to military school if he didn't improve. Their threats were hollow, and Smitty, as he was now known, was allowed to live his life as he pleased. Although his high school years were lackluster, it was during this time that he began to have highly sexualized fantasies of hurting women. He shared with his best friend Paul that he would love to run down the streets naked, masturbating, and yelling at everyone in sight. Paul found these remarks odd, but there was much more to his friend than his rantings and ravings. As Smitty entered his teenage years in the late 50s, he began to fixate on his small stature. He expected to grow more, but he stopped growing once he reached 5'3", or 160 centimeters. This was unacceptable to the image he wanted to portray, so he began stuffing his shoes with small tin cans and rags. This added another 3 inches to his height. He endured the pain that caused him to walk like he had a lead foot. None of his friends knew that he did this, and some people even thought he walked so strangely because he had a wooden foot. His eyes were the only real thing about him, his friends would later say. They were cool and ocean blue. His girlfriends teetered on being completely creeped out or completely enamored with him. There was no in-between. The parents of his friends found him amiable, polite, and well-mannered. Around the age of 16, he was told by many female classmates that he resembled Elvis Presley. He took this compliment to heart and began cultivating the image that would later be splattered over newspapers everywhere. His parents were relatively absent during his teenage years. He moved into a cottage on his family's estate and was given $300 a month in allowance, a motorcycle, and a car. Smitty didn't seem to mind the independence. He was content being on his own and left to his own devices. His home decor included posters of women, Playboy magazines, and Elvis Presley. It was during his senior year of high school that things took a turn for the worse. He was in the machine shop at his high school and took some tools home to fix up his car. When school officials discovered what he had done, he was suspended for theft. Having an excuse to skip school, Smitty decided to never return as a student. Instead, he would hang out with his former classmates once they were released from school for the day. He became acquainted with a young student named Mary French. Mary was 18 years old when she met Smitty and was immediately captivated by him. She followed him around like a lost puppy, and he loved every minute of her attention. He wasn't entirely attracted to her, but knew she was pliable to his whims. Smitty invited Mary over to his cottage. He would belittle her frumpy physique and encouraged her to bleach her hair blonde, which she also complied with. Unlike his idol, Smitty was obsessed with blondes. Anyone he dated or was involved with, he would encourage them to bleach their hair. In the same respect, his appearance would begin to change drastically. He began to wear tan powder on his face, so much that it was visibly caked on. He fashioned a mole out of putty and axle grease that seemed to grow larger every time he put it on his face. He forced his eyelids to droop and pursed his lips to mimic Elvis. In March of 1962, 19-year-old Smitty and his best friend Paul Ginn headed to Balboa Island in Newport Beach, California. They were looking for a good time, and according to Paul and Smitty's accounts of the vacation, Smitty was attacked by a gang in Los Angeles. They were looking for a good time, and according to Paul and Smitty's accounts of the vacation, Smitty was attacked by a gang in Los Angeles. They busted him over the nose with a lead pipe, which forced Smitty to seek medical attention and to wear a brace on his nose with a metal plate to keep it aligned. This would soon become a part of his everyday wardrobe. He liked the attention it brought him, especially the sympathy it elicited from the women around him. Rumors about Smitty were abundant. There were claims that he ran a sex ring of eager young girls who were enticed by the money. It was also said that he was the leader of a sex club where potential new members had to have sex in front of other members in order to be initiated. The validity of these rumors have never been substantiated. Despite his seemingly abundant confidence, Smitty seemed to always have a woe-is-me attitude with his friends. Around the age of 18, he was finally told that he had been adopted. He was able to connect with his birth mother, but the reunion was largely a disappointment. The woman, who has not been identified, demanded that Smitty never contact her again. This rejection further solidified his hatred for women, though he would later contest this. Paul recalled a particularly disturbing incident involving Smitty's pet cat, where he beat it to death against a wall. With his face speckled with the blood of his cat and out of breath, Smitty turned to Paul and said, "Why do you have compassion?" Paul was terrified of Smitty after this brutal incident, but failed to share what he had witnessed. He didn't want whatever anger and aggression that was living inside of Smitty to turn on him. In November of 1962, he was arrested for creating an unlawful diversion. He was bailed out and charges were dropped thanks to his father's connection to the community. He felt untouchable, and the lack of accountability from his family only encouraged him to continue acting out. He entered into relationships with girls who were enamored by his persona. When he was bored, he dropped them, completely devastating them. He often bragged to Paul that that was one of his favorite ways to torture women. He found this form of manipulation particularly satisfying. When Mary dropped out of school, Smitty invited her to live with him in his cottage. He told multiple friends that they were married, and Mary was an accomplice to this lie. She introduced him as her husband to her friends, who she had over at his house to drink and party. Eileen Rowe was 15 years old when she first met Smitty. She was taken aback by his dramatic appearance and was creeped out by his demeanor. Mary insisted that Smitty was cool and that there was no other place in town where they could drink and read raunchy detective magazines. Eileen was a typical 15-year-old girl. She was very studious and enjoyed school, but liked to let off steam during the weekends. The main haunt for teenagers in the Tucson area was known as the Speedway. Teenagers would cruise up and down the street in their muscle cars, yelling at their friends while hanging out of the car window. They would park and eat at the local food mart or soda fountain. Smitty would often drive up and down the speedway, showing off his car and picking up friends to take to his cottage. Smitty's parents discovered that Mary was living with Smitty and ordered her out of the home. Smitty, upset by the intrusion, insisted that his parents hire Mary to work at the nursing home. They honored their son's request, and Mary found herself with a new job. Smitty encouraged her to deposit her paycheck in his bank account. He told her he planned to marry her, so they might as well share the same money. Mary did whatever Smitty said, and when she was issued her very first check, she handed it over. Smitty thought he had everything figured out. After the incident where he brutally murdered his cat, his lust for blood couldn't be quenched. In late May of 1964, Mary and their mutual friend John Saunders were drinking heavily at Smitty's home, he confessed his true desire to them both, telling them he wanted to murder someone before the month was over. Mary, instead of being aghast at the confession, asked him, "Who do you want to kill?" He shrugged his shoulders and rattled off a couple of names. One name stood out to Mary, and that was her friend, 15-year-old Eileen Rowe. Smitty practically salivated at the idea. He contemplated ways to entice Eileen to his home. Mary spoke up and offered to bring Eileen over to her home. She was ready to do anything for him, even help him kill. On May 31st, 1964, just 2 weeks after declaring his urge to kill, Smitty informed John and Mary that he was ready. They stopped by a nearby hardware store to purchase a shovel, and Mary did her part. She called Eileen to tell her about a party happening at her house that night. Initially reserved, Eileen agreed to sneak out of her house. She didn't care for Smitty's company, but if Mary was there, she felt more comfortable. Norma Rowe, Eileen's mother, worked the night shift as an RN at the local hospital. She recounted to Time Life magazine in 1966, the last time she saw her daughter alive. She stated Eileen was wearing a bathing suit with a blouse over it and orange flip-flops. They watched Ed Sullivan because the Beatles were playing and danced around the living room. Her time to head to work was approaching, and she hugged her daughter, noticing a faint smell of perfume. She held her at shoulder's length and looked at her with concern. Eileen assured her that she was just smelling her bath soap. She had a test at 6 a.m. and needed to get to bed. Norma kissed her daughter's cheek and hugged her one last time. Before she left for her shift, Norma checked on Eileen to find her sound asleep in bed. When her mother pulled out of the driveway, Eileen waited for the signal to exit her home. Mary approached Eileen's window and tapped on it. She slipped her flip-flops on and climbed out the window. She was initially caught off guard to see Smitty and John Saunders in the car, but she shrugged it off. After all, the three were almost always together. Smitty began driving to the desert, claiming he found an isolated place to smoke their cigarettes, drink, and talk without interruption. When they arrived to their destination, all four of them exited the vehicle and made their way to the small embankment. They passed around beers and smoked. They talked about their lives and woes for about 45 minutes. Smitty and John nodded towards each other, giving each other a signal that it was time to move on Eileen. Smitty stood up and asked Mary to join him while he walked back to the car. Eileen must have thought the couple would go back to his car and make out while leaving her and John to wait until they returned. She didn't really know what Mary saw in Smitty, but she figured she was just having fun. She looked over her shoulder while watching the couple walk up the embankment. She turned around and was surprised by a hit to the head. John Saunders had picked up a large rock and hit her as she returned her attention to him. She let out a scream, but quickly lost consciousness. Mary didn't turn around. She just kept walking towards the car and sat in the back seat, waiting for Smitty and John to be done.
I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor.
Smitty returned to help John beat and strangle Eileen. Her death was rather quick, and Smitty felt amazing after the murder. He ordered John to grab Mary and the shovel. Initially, Mary refused, but eventually went down when Smitty called her a second time. The three buried Eileen's body and belongings separately. They were full of adrenaline, but knew they had to wipe all traces of Eileen from the car. One of the many problems with Smitty was his inability to be humble. He was braggadocious when it came to his sexual exploits, and now to murder, although his sexual encounters were likely fabricated. In the weeks that followed Eileen's murder, Norma Rowe knew that Smitty had something to do with her daughter's disappearance. She implored the authorities to look into him, but they had already spoken to him and corroborated the alibi he gave. Norma never gave up looking for her daughter. She tried to follow Smitty around town, but it was making her extremely nervous, and she eventually gave up. The Tucson police treated Norma as a naive mother whose daughter had likely run away with a boy. They did not take her disappearance seriously and failed to source any credible leads. In July of 1964, Smitty spotted 17-year-old Gretchen Fritz at the local pool. She was the daughter of a prominent heart surgeon in Tucson. She was spoiled and rich. Her father couldn't tame her and was too busy on his practice to focus on disciplining her. She attended an exclusive private school where part of the curriculum involved equestrian sports. Gretchen was also promiscuous and would often charge boys for sex. She scolded her classmates for having sex for free. She was eventually expelled from school after stealing from a liquor store. She loved committing theft. The adrenaline rush she got from it excited her. She stole often and for no reason at all. Instead of introducing himself at the pool, Smitty trailed Gretchen to her home. He stopped to admire the greatness of her home and knew that her access to money was going to help him get the things he wanted from her. He knocked on her door. When she answered, she looked him up and down, impressed and bewildered at the same time. She waited for him to introduce himself, but all he muttered was, "Don't I know you?" Gretchen was impressed by his forwardness and invited him in. Mary was immediately jealous of Smitty's infatuation with Gretchen. She was everything Mary was not. She was pretty, rich, and slim. She also fed a ravenous need in Smitty for turmoil. Their relationship was a roller coaster. Mary often played with a $13 engagement ring that Smitty gave her when he proposed to her. She decided the only way she would keep his attention was to lie and say she was pregnant. Smitty raised his brows and shrugged his shoulders, saying, "Are you sure it's mine, Mary?" She didn't say another word and never spoke of being pregnant again. She knew what he did to Eileen, and she wasn't sure if he would turn his lust for murder on her. Smitty and Gretchen's relationship was a roller coaster. One minute, they would be claiming their undying love for each other, and the next, Smitty would slap her across the face, calling her a bitch and a whore. Gretchen lived for the moments of anger in her relationship with Smitty. She didn't care much for Mary and was extremely jealous and possessive of Smitty. Richard Bruns, an 18-year-old acquaintance of Smitty's, began hanging around his house regularly after John Saunders left town to join the Navy. He became a close friend to Smitty. Smitty had a way of attracting misfits to his circle of friends, and Richard was no different. He was present for much of Gretchen and Smitty's relationship. One day in early 1965, Smitty shared with Richard that he had murdered Eileen Rowe, the young woman who had been missing since the summer of 1964. He also shared this information with Gretchen. By this time, Gretchen and Smitty were constantly fighting. She wanted Smitty all to herself and was extremely jealous of him hanging out with other girls and other men. When Gretchen pulled up to his home and made a scene, Smitty wrote to the Arizona Department of Health and accused Gretchen of having a venereal disease. He spread the rumor around town to the embarrassment of Gretchen's father. He had finally had enough of their relationship and ordered her to stay away from Smitty. Gretchen, however, was never the obedient type and continued her relationship with Smitty. After the venereal disease incident, Gretchen began threatening Smitty and telling him that she would tell the police about what he told her about murdering Eileen. To Smitty, this threatened his freedom, and he couldn't have that. The fall of 1965 found a 23-year-old Smitty at a financial loss. His parents had filed for bankruptcy and limited his monthly allowance. He was infuriated by this revelation and turned his frustrations towards Gretchen. He accused her of stealing his diary, which held information about a supposed murder that took place on the East Coast. He told Richard and Mary about his plans to murder Gretchen. Richard did not take him seriously at first. He knew how often Smitty made up stories, and he figured this was no different. On August 16, 1965, Gretchen and her 13-year-old sister Wendy were getting ready to head out to a drive-in movie. They were excited to catch the brand new Elvis Presley film, Tickle Me. Unbeknownst to Wendy, Gretchen planned to stop by Smitty's house before the movie. Annoyed by the diversion, Wendy had no choice but to go inside Smitty's home. When the girls arrived, Smitty attacked Gretchen first, strangling her until she died. He then turned his attention on Wendy, killing her in the same way. Out of breath and completely exhilarated, he drove Gretchen's car up the street and parked it behind a local motel. He returned to his home and tossed their bodies in the back of his trunk. He took them to the desert and left them out in the open in a popular area for teenagers to hang out and party. Dr. James Fritt asked his wife, Nancy, if the girls made it home. She said no and was worried because the movie was likely already over. They phoned the Tucson Police Department and drove around searching for the girls. When they arrived to the police station to file a report, they got the feeling that police believed the girls had simply run away. Dr. Fritz's status in the community did not influence the investigation, and he took matters into his own hands and hired a private investigator. To their credit, the Tucson police spoke with Smitty since he had now come up in two disappearances. Once again, Mary corroborated his alibi. He told police that Gretchen often talked about running away to Mexico since her home life was so bad. He said that she probably took Wendy to give her the same opportunity. Detectives somewhat believed the speculation. After all, it was the late 1960s, and teenage runaways, especially in the Tucson area, were a dime a dozen. The private investigator hired by the Fritz also spoke with Smitty, but walked away with no reliable information. The investigator discovered Gretchen's car a mile away from Smitty's home. He contacted the police, who searched the vehicle for evidence. The only thing they found was a business card of Smitty's failed upholstery business. Their case eventually went cold. A week later, Smitty confessed his crimes to Richard Bruns. Richard, again, didn't really believe Smitty's tall tales. In a way, he wished it were true. He couldn't stand Gretchen and was glad that, in one way or another, she was gone from his life. Of course, he didn't wish her dead. He believed, like many others, that she and Wendy had simply run away. In the book he wrote about his relationship with Smitty, Ias Wheeler, Richard recalls one particularly scary night in 1965. Several men had picked them up from Smitty's home, and Smitty whispered that these were mafia men. The men questioned Smitty and Richard for several hours. Smitty, according to Richard, remained calm and said that if they ended up finding out that Gretchen had been hurt, he wanted in on beating the men up. He shrugged off their concerns and said the girls probably ran away to Hollywood. They loved Elvis, and maybe Gretchen was just giving Wendy an adventure. Richard remained mum during the meeting, denying having any knowledge of the girls' whereabouts. The men dropped them back off at Smitty's house and drove away. After the meeting, Smitty was in a rage, feeling disrespected and manhandled was something he simply could not tolerate. He contacted the FBI and complained that the mafia was harassing him and his friends about Gretchen Fritz. He claimed that Gretchen's father was behind the ambush. Richard began to realize that perhaps Smitty was telling the truth. Smitty had the idea to move the girls' bodies from their current location. They were in a place where they could easily be discovered, and Smitty could possibly be implicated in the murders. Smitty convinced Richard to help him. Richard agreed, half believing that this was all some sort of joke. Smitty and Richard gathered some shovels and headed out towards the desert. Smitty and Richard searched around the dark before they found the girls' bodies. Richard was horrified at the state of them, but it was too late to back out now. The two men dug fresh graves and buried the Fritz sisters. The following week, Smitty said he was accompanying the mafia guys to California to look for Gretchen and Wendy. Richard was confused and afraid by this revelation. While in San Diego, Smitty was arrested for impersonating an FBI agent. He was released the following day with a warning. He and the men returned to Tucson after having no luck in finding Gretchen. Of course, Richard knew why. On September 9, 1965, 23-year-old Smitty went on a blind date with 15-year-old Diane Lynch. Their romance was a whirlwind, and that same month, he and Diane married. It was a shock to both families, but there was nothing they could do or say to change the pair's mind. Richard noticed a rapid decline in Smitty's behavior. He would run around the house screaming obscenities and punching the walls. Richard believed his friend was going crazy, but had no way to stop him. Richard wasn't immune from quirks of his own. He fell in love with 16-year-old Kathy Morath after she threw a fake engagement ring back in Smitty's face. His feelings for her weren't as strongly reciprocated. For Kathy, Richard was a rebound love. Eventually, she ended their relationship, and Richard found it hard to cope. He began writing to her almost daily. The writings would consist of love poems and long, drawn-out love letters. Kathy's father became concerned with the older boy's infatuation with his daughter. Richard became paranoid that Smitty was plotting to kill Kathy and convinced himself that he had to protect her at all costs. He began sitting outside of her house and following her around town to ensure she was safe at all times. Of course, this level of devotion frightened the Morath family, and Richard was approached by police several times. In October 1965, he was arrested for the continued harassment of the Morath family. The judge in his case ordered him to leave the Tucson area in order to get over his obsession. Richard informed Smitty that he had to go to Ohio for a few months to live with his grandmother. Smitty was too busy with his new wife to care. He had no inkling that Richard suspected he might hurt Kathy. Overwhelmed by the thoughts of potential harm that could befall Kathy, Richard drowns them all in alcohol. One night, he stumbled drunk into his grandmother's kitchen and tearfully shared what he knew about Eileen, Gretchen, and Wendy's deaths. His grandmother attempted to comfort him, thinking he was saying this all out of a drunken stupor. This enraged Richard, and he called the Tucson police to tell them he knew where the bodies of all three victims were located. That same week, he returned to Arizona to provide a formal statement. Just like that, Smitty's tower of control began to crumble all around him. He, Mary, and John are picked up in question in the death of Eileen Rowe. Mary and John's charges were brought against them in November of 1965. The judge placed a gag order on the police and sequestered the jury at a local motel. For their parts, Mary French and John Saunders immediately confessed to their involvement in the death of Eileen Rowe. Richard Bruns confesses to his involvement in helping Smitty rebury the Fritz girls. Mary French, for her role in the murder of Eileen Rowe, was sentenced to 4 years in prison, while John Saunders received life in prison. Despite his accomplices pleading guilty to their parts in the murder of Eileen, Smitty pled not guilty. He also pled not guilty to the murders of Gretchen and Wendy Fritz. Prosecutors wanted to try the Rowe case first. That way, if Smitty was convicted, then the conviction could be used against him as a motive for why he murdered the Fritz sisters. However, Smitty requested that he be tried for the Fritz murders first, and the judge granted him his wish. The trial for the Fritz sisters began in February 1966. In accordance with their plea deals, both Mary French and John Saunders testified against Smitty. Saunders, however, asserted his Fifth Amendment rights for the majority of the testimony. Richard Bruns also testified against Smitty, telling the court about how he helped Smitty move the bodies of the sisters. Smitty did not testify at his trial. It only took the jury 30 minutes to find 23-year-old Charles Smith Jr. guilty of the murders of Gretchen and Wendy Fritz. On March 25, 1966, he was sentenced to death. Smitty's lawyer, Bill Tinney, decided to bring in F. Lee Bailey, a well-known lawyer, to help with the Rowe case. Bailey was an aggressive young man, and Smitty thought he would be able to help him beat the case. The trial began in May 1967. Smitty initially pled not guilty to the murder of Rowe, but as the trial went on, it became clearer and clearer that Smitty was going to lose. John Saunders was again called to the stand and again asserted his Fifth Amendment rights during his testimony. However, the prosecutor was able to read to the jury John Saunders' testimony that he gave in the preliminary hearings. In order to allow the jury to mull over Saunders' testimony, the prosecutor called for a recess. Upon returning, Bailey announced that Smitty would be pleading guilty to second-degree murder should the prosecutor agree. He did, and Smitty had to admit in open court that he killed 15-year-old Eileen Rowe. A few days later, Smitty reasserted his innocence and filed a motion to fire both his lawyers. Upon hearing his motion, both of his lawyers quit. The judge would not allow Smitty to withdraw his guilty plea. He sentenced Smitty to 50 years to life for the murder of Eileen Rowe. A few weeks after his sentencing, Smitty decides to throw a Hail Mary in order to save his life. Smitty tells police he'll show them where Eileen is buried. Once they dig her up, they'll see that she wasn't bludgeoned over the head, thus proving that both French and Saunders lied about the murder. Police and the prosecutor agreed to let Smitty out to lead them to Eileen's body. Smitty led them to the outskirts of Tucson, near where French and Saunders had taken police months earlier. Smitty admitted to moving the body after the initial murder. It took him a little time to get oriented, but once he did, he led the small crowd of investigators and press to a spot about 20 yards away from where he initially buried Eileen. Police carefully dug into the sand and found Eileen's body about a foot under the surface. Smitty helped investigators clear the sand away from Eileen's skull, promising them that they would see there was no fracture and his name would be cleared. However, once the skull was removed from the ground, a large fracture consistent with being hit by a rock was clearly evident. Smitty files multiple appeals, but the courts continue to uphold his death sentence. In 1971, Smitty will escape death when the death penalty is overturned in Arizona. His death sentences were commuted to 50 years. The prospect of spending 50 years in jail was just as unappealing to Smitty as a death sentence. In October of 1972, he attempted to escape prison by hiding inside a hollow gymnastics horse. He was found later by guards hiding in a clothes locker in the prison welding shop. Undeterred by his previous failure, Smitty made another escape attempt the next month. He was a lot more successful this time. The details on how he escaped are not clear, but Smitty and his accomplice, 32-year-old Raymond Hutchins, escaped Arizona State Prison on November 11, 1972. The next day, Smitty and Hutchins broke into a home in Pinal County, Arizona. Using a homemade zip gun, Smitty and Hutchins took in four hostages. They forced the hostages to drive them to Tempe, Arizona, where they left them unharmed. The two men split up, and Smitty was found by police 2 days later in a Tucson rail yard. He was wearing a woman's wig in order to hide his appearance, but police weren't fooled. Also in 1974, Smitty legally changed his name to Paul David Ashley. His reasoning was that he would not be able to move forward in life as Charles Schmidt. A new name would help him with that transition. On March 10, 1975, Smitty was attacked by two fellow prisoners. Reports vary on the exact number of stab wounds Smitty received, but it's somewhere between 20 and 47. Smitty received some very gruesome injuries from this attack. He received damage to one eye, one lung, received a severe slash to his stomach and intestines, sustained damage to his ureter, as well as other stab wounds to his face, chest, and torso. Doctors had to remove his right eye and suture his lung. Soon, his body was overcome with a blood infection and his kidneys failed. Charles Schmidt Jr., or Paul David Ashley, died 10 days after the attack on March 20th, 1975. He was 32 years old. Smitty's adoptive parents declined to claim his body, and he was buried in the prison cemetery. Earlier in this episode, I mentioned the book I, a Squealer by Richard Bruns. We were made aware of this book thanks to Richard's daughter, Lisa Espich. She wrote into the show and asked if we would cover this case. After researching the case and Richard's involvement in it, we had some questions for Lisa and Richard. We thank them both for being forthcoming in their responses, and hope that their responses shed light for you on Richard's mindset in 1964 and 1965. Our first question, does Bruns feel like Schmid was a good person who snapped? Answer, no. He now realizes that he was a psychopath and not capable of empathy or true feelings for anyone other than himself. Schmid's friendship to my father was just an act, but my father now knows that Schmid didn't care about their friendship at all. Next question. Did Bruns change any of the manuscript before it was published, or is this all from the mind of a 21-year-old man? Answer. As far as changing the manuscript, it was all kept exactly how it was originally written, except for having an editor go through to fix any grammatical errors. The publisher felt it was very important to keep the integrity of the original writing, since this was much like a memoir of the time. My father actually refused to read the book until after it was published. I am glad he chose to do that, because after reading it, there were things he would have liked to change because his opinions and feelings have changed over time. Because so much happened regarding these cases after the original writing, the appendix sections were added to update the reader. Next question. Did Bruns continue to experience PTSD-like symptoms after Schmidt's conviction? Answer. My father was never diagnosed with PTSD, which wasn't even a diagnosis available at that time. But he definitely struggled to move forward from these cases. I know that he was forever changed and received no counseling or treatment of any kind. I'm sure he would have benefited from some type of psychological treatment, but instead, he was just expected to move on like nothing ever happened. Our final question. Looking back, does Bruns think he would ever have gone to the police had he not been shipped off to Ohio? Answer. Being sent to Ohio was the catalyst for coming forward, but he would have eventually gone to the police had it not happened. He knows he couldn't have continued on for much longer, and was growing more and more afraid of what Schmid might do. The end was definitely coming near, and he felt he was playing a chess game with Schmid. As soon as he had no ability to protect Kathy, he didn't hesitate to come forward. I wanted to add some additional information for the question we answered earlier regarding my father going to the police. I know that many people question why somebody would wait to go to the police if they knew that a friend might be responsible for killing three girls. I always like to remind people that this happened in the late 1960s, before things like DNA, computer records, and cell phone records were available. Today, if you know someone is responsible for a killing, you can feel confident in going to the police and knowing that there are ways to prove a case. At the time of these cases, my dad had no real evidence except Schmidt's stories. The police had already questioned Schmidt about the cases and they had no proof either. When my father was taken out to the bodies, he finally had proof, but Schmidt had convinced them that he was now just as guilty for attempting to help him bury the bodies. At that time, he believed he might go to prison for doing that, and as an 18-year-old man, he was afraid of facing that fate. While he knew he would eventually need to come forward, he was also very afraid. That's just some additional food for thought on the subject. I want to thank Lisa and Richard Bruns again for providing these answers to us. If you're interested in reading Richard's account of his time with Charles Smith Jr., check out his book, I, a Squealer. It is available on Amazon and other book retailers. A link will be in the show notes. Okay, fan club members, as I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast player of choice. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast, Instagram, TCFC_podcast, and of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. Music for the show was composed by Nico at We Talk of Dreams. Check him out on Twitter at We Talk of Dreams or WeTalkOfDreams.com. Audio engineering is provided by Ches Gray, who manages Ches Gray Music. Content warning at the top of the episode was provided by Tyler Allen, host of the Minds of Madness podcast. Content editing and research assistance for this show is provided by Brittany Martinez.